Welcome back to the Language Creation Society podcast.
I'm Cy Emrys.
And I'm Sally Caves.
On the podcast with us today, we have Dr. Suzette Hayden Elgin, author of many books, including the Native Tongue Trilogy, the Ozark Trilogy, and many more, as well as nonfiction about the gentle art of verbal self-defense.
We discuss her invented language, La'adan. La'adan is unusual in that it is intended to express women's perspectives and thought more easily than can be done in other languages, which she believes implicitly exclude the expression of peculiarly female experiences.
I think you know who I am, and you know who Sally/Sarah is. Could you please introduce yourself?
I'm Suzette Hayden Elgin. I'm a retired linguistics professor, retired from San Diego State University, did my graduate work in Navajo at UCSB, and the only conlang I have worked with is the one called La'adan, which was part of my science fiction trilogy called Native Tongue, written back in the 80s.
And I believe you've also written some books about communication styles and defensive communication.
Yes. I also wrote the Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense series. There are about 14 books in that series.
Could you explain what that is about?
It's about how to establish a language environment where hostile language is extremely rare, and when you do actually have to deal with it, how to deal with it effectively and efficiently without any loss of face on either side.
Could you explain what La'adan is for the people who don't know about it?
Well, I was writing a novel about some linguist women who invented a language. And it's like if I were a rocket scientist, I would want to put something in about rockets. I felt that in order to be ethically correct as a novelist, I had to actually construct a language. And I decided as part of the plot that it should be a language that was designed to express the perceptions of women.
Why did that come up as part of the plot?
Well, because when I was working on the novel in the first place, the first one, I was also hearing from something called muted group theory. And muted group theory postulates that women are inadequately served by existing languages because the languages that they have do not express their perceptions adequately. And I was interested in that idea. It came from Edwin Ardner in 1975. And it just fit into the book very neatly.
I find this interesting. In your second edition of the Dictionary and Grammar of La'adan, you state that this is a language constructed by a woman for women for the specific purpose of expressing that perception of women. And that's what you so eloquently said right now. And I want to know where elsewhere you also say that it's an ideal language for young men to learn, because I think that has been a question that you have been dealing with for decades.
Yes, I made it very explicit in the book. In Judith Rose, I have Nazareth, who's a heroine, who is thinking about how wonderful it will be in the days when La'adan is spoken everywhere and when children are exposed to it and both boys and girls learn it. I was very explicit about that. And in spite of that fact, from the very beginning, I have been accused of having said that it was a language intended only for women and that men weren't allowed to use it and all sorts of very odd things like that. And I really went out of my way to make it clear that the women of the linguist lines in the book envisaged a day when all genders would learn that language.
I suspect that that those people only read Native Tongue and didn't give me the entire trilogy.
If I may comment, it seems to me that you're not so much creating a woman's language specifically, so much as a language for people who are empathetic in general and trying to highlight the emotional side of conversation. Would you agree with that?
No. No, I don't agree with it at all. I was to construct a language that would fill up a lot of the holes in the communication that women have to do in English, which is the only language I know enough about to speak for women, you know, as a group. The problem that women have in communicating, often, especially with men, is that they find that they have to go on and on and on and on, and the man says, will you please get to the point? There's no way to get to the point because there isn't an adequate vocabulary and there aren't adequate semantic structures. And so I was trying to devise the language that would take care of that problem. Now the reason that it has a lot of emotional vocabulary is not because I thought emotion was so extraordinarily important, but that for many women, there are all these different kinds of love and all these different kinds of sorrow and all these different kinds of joy, and there's no way at all to talk about them conveniently. So I added that kind of vocabulary. Does that help at all?
Yes, it does. I wanted to ask you if you could tell us more about the evidence morpheme, which is something that really interests me. I've encountered it in Native American languages.
Yes, the evidentials, as they're called. I thought that that was a very useful sort of thing because it says specifically why it is that the speaker feels that he or she has the right to state what is being stated in the sentence. And that means that if you end a sentence by saying, you know, I am really hungry, and you end it with an evidential that says, according to the testimony of my own senses, that's why I'm saying this, then it becomes very difficult for someone to say back to you, oh, you are not.
Yes.
You know, I'm hungry, I'm tired. Oh, you are not. Oh, you can't be. You know, so it's more difficult to contradict when you have stated specifically what the evidence for your claim is at the end of your sentence.
It seems to me that this demonstration of evidence is a social convention, and people exaggerate in English when they say, for example, I was literally walking on air yesterday. They weren't actually literally walking on air. That's just an exaggeration. And it seems to me that without a significantly different social context, people could use these evidentials in similarly inaccurate ways, where they just use it for figurative purposes. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, English is well known for having evidentials. It just doesn't have them as a specific form, class, or part of speech. It doesn't have them obligatorily in every sentence the way Lahadan does. And certainly, you can lie in Lahadan just as well as you can lie in any other language, and you can use it figuratively or metaphorically, but there is a certain amount of signal to it. There's a speech act morpheme at the beginning of the sentence which says, I'm saying this as, and they'll say as a statement, I'm saying it as a teaching, I'm saying it as a story, I'm saying it as a joke, and then at the end there's the evidential that says on what basis you're making that claim. And it seems to me that this, in many ways, what it does is it lexicalizes, that is, it gives a surface form to a lot of work that women have to do in communicating in English, and that they can only do through body language and intonation, tone of voice, that sort of thing.
They can also say things like, I feel that, or I suggest that, or I have understood that, and They can say that in English, but the problem seems to be is that speakers of English or any other language love the direct statement, that that's strong, and that any other evidentials seem weak, and we're not getting over this. And I wondered, actually, what if in Lahadan someone left off the evidence morpheme? Could Lahadan be used perniciously that way?
If you left off the evidence morpheme, it would mean that you were unwilling to state what the basis of your claim was. And if you did that, your sentence would be ungrammatical. It would be very obvious. Now, in connected discourse, when the same evidential is applies to sentence after sentence after sentence. You don't have to say it every single time. You know, that's absurd, of course. But any time that it changes, you have to put one in there, or the sentence itself is not grammatical. And that's true, for example, for Aymara, the language of Peru.
That's interesting.
Exactly the same phenomenon in the real world.
If I may, on your website, you have an essay about La'adan. And in it, you say that you had four goals in making the language. Namely, first, to test the weak form of the Saper-Whorf hypothesis.
Right.
Which is that languages structure perception in certain ways. Second, that Gödel's theorem applies to language. Third, that language brings about social change rather than the other way around. And fourth, that if women were offered a women's language, either they'd welcome and nurture it, or at least use it to replace some of their things in their own language. Could you explain what you mean by those?
Well, I was completely wrong, of course. I had really thought that if women encountered, if women were presented with something that's claiming to be a language that expresses the perception of women, they would either be very pleased to have it and put it to use, or they would say, well, that's not my idea of what it should be like at all, and they would do something as an alternative. And that was very naive of me, because, of course, people weren't particularly interested in this language. It wasn't backed up by Paramount Pictures the way Klingon was. It didn't take the world by storm. The other three items are a bit easier to explain. The one about testing it as a weak form of the Saper-Whorf hypothesis, I did that using the novel. And in the novel, in native tongue, in the first book, it actually did work. It did affect the perceptions of women in a particular way, and it did bring about social change. Now, in the real world, so far as I can determine, it has had no effect whatsoever. The part about Gödel's theorem, I was reading Gödel-Escher Bach at the time that I was writing the novel, and in there is a dialogue where they talk about the fact that there could be records that you could not put on a record player because they would destroy the record player. And I thought, all right, you could have a language that you could not introduce into a culture because it would destroy the culture. And that is what happened in native tongue.
Do you think that's accurate? Or more accurately, do you think that's plausible?
I do think it's plausible. I think if a language were introduced into a culture, well, we've seen it happen. You know, when you have pidgins and creoles, we've seen drastic changes in human cultures after another language is introduced. It depends on what comes with it. You know, if you have big historical events, then you have conquest, and you have war, and you have trade and all of that, then, of course, it's plausible that the language is going to destroy the culture that it goes into.
What about our efforts in English to change stewardess, for instance, into flight attendant, or waitress into table server, and other examples? Are we moving ever so slightly in that direction?
I don't think so. I wish we were. I do think that people are perhaps a little more careful about it when they're, particularly in written language, they're more careful about it because they're concerned about being perceived as politically correct. But I don't think that we have made any particular progress with changing the language. I think there's too much resistance to it. However, I think that is perhaps not true for our really younger generation.
Yeah.
The really young kids, they seem to be making a lot of progress, and I have a lot of hope for them. People my age, people 40 or older, I don't think there's been very much progress.
It's like technology, the new sort of digital generation.
Especially what they call the millennials. They don't seem to have the sexual, the gender differences that the over 40s have at all. They just amaze me as a hopeful sign.
That they would include me, by the way.
Oh, good. Yeah, they surprise me constantly. On my LiveJournal blog, I have huge numbers of very young people, and their behavior, their language behavior, just astonishes me constantly.
Boy, that's not something I've been exposed to. I'm interested in that. I teach 18, 19, 20-year-olds, because my next question was about digital gaming, where you see mostly games that are aimed at a violence and bonding between men, and very few games that have anything to do with a female interest. So I was wondering if you think the world can be as interested in women and their world as it is in combat and bonding between men, and I'm talking about games like World of Warcraft. Everybody seems to be going into this virtual reality thing.
It seems to me that the really young kids are, in a lot of ways, androgynous, sense that I would never have imagined. But what that seems to mean a great deal of the time is that the women are just as interested in the violence as men are.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily an improvement.
No.
So if you have someone who is by nature nonviolent, they are going to stay that way. But if I see a tendency toward a great deal of aggression in the very young women, and they're very comfortable with it. They're not the least bit self-effacing. They're not shy.
Perhaps this is a good thing.
I don't know. I don't know how it's going to turn out. You know, I'm often astonished at the things that my readers on my blog feel perfectly free to say to me. They know I'm a 73-year-old linguist ex-professor, you know, grandmother and all of that sort of thing. It doesn't hold them back a bit. They just tell me off without hesitation. And that has been very surprising to me. But then I observe them at science fiction conventions, for example, and I don't see the differences between the genders that I see in the over 40s at all. And I don't know what that means, and I don't know where it's headed.
In a class I taught a year ago, it was an honors course on imaginary language, I gave my students parts of your dictionary and grammar to discuss, the second edition. And the reactions to it range from wildly enthusiastic to bewildered. And one young woman, who was a freshman, objected precisely because of the evidence morpheme coming at the end of the sentence and also because of the speech act morphing at the beginning. This was her direct quote. "I wouldn't know how to tell how I came by my information. I often don't know what I'm saying until I say it. This would kill me." How would you advise her?
Well, you know, at one point with one of my newsletters, I did a sort of poll. I was trying to find out why precisely Vaadan had failed so dismally, you know, to appeal to women. And over and over and over, I got two specific reasons. One was they were too busy. Okay, and I understand that. But the other one was because I would feel so vulnerable ending every sentence, why I was saying it, you know, what genre of sentence it was. And at the end of it, I had to say how I knew that I was free to say that. I would feel incredibly vulnerable and exposed. And, of course, we know that the reason that English is the language of business, preferred language of business all over the world, is because it's the language in which it is easiest to deceive and to lead people astray, and it's the most deniable language you could possibly want, and it's incredibly handy that way. And these women were saying, I'm not going to give those things up and expose myself in that fashion.
In other words, the woman is saying, I am going to speak the language of business and talk like men. In other words, to be successful, to compete with men, you have to in some ways adopt masculine discourse and not be vulnerable.
I'm sure that's true, but I think it's just as true in the home, you know, as it is in the workplace. I think that is the women who were saying this to me were saying, having to say why I'm saying things and on what basis I'm saying them would expose me. It would make me feel vulnerable. It would make me feel unsafe. And therefore, I would never be interested in a language of this kind. And this came as a real surprise to me. It was not something I had at all anticipated.
That's interesting. I think that my student was saying something of that sort, but she was also confessing to an inability, basically, to articulate what her thought was going to be. And perhaps this is a fault of language, as I hear it being used vernacularly.
We never get any training in English communication in thinking before we speak. And people don't want to bother.
Exactly.
They just want to say whatever pops into their head, and we get in all sorts of trouble that way.
Right. Another question I wanted to ask you is, well, actually, it's a kind of a statement. Much of La Don reminds me of E Prime, and you're
really
familiar with that, yes.
Could you explain what that is for the listeners?
Okay, it was a thought experiment originally devised to make scientific language more precise by getting rid of the copula, is, would be, was, that sort of thing, so that instead of saying light is a wave, it was counseled to say light behaves like a wave under certain circumstances, and this avoids blanket statements. And it probably would work in a scientific environment, but it was extended to as a thought experiment for all language, and it was roundly rejected, I think, for a lot of the same reasons.
One of the problems with E-Prime is that there are so many languages that don't use a copula. You know, all over the world. I was very impressed by the list of languages that you know. I went to your website and read your material there, and most Native American languages don't have a copula, and it doesn't affect what they say in any particular way. And so that I'm not sure exactly why La Don reminds you of E-Prime. That is, it's not that it's not sufficiently developed as a language to have a really sophisticated scientific vocabulary, it doesn't seem to me. So it wouldn't be that you had seen lots of La-Don sentences that were like the example that you just gave, for instance.
I suppose what I was thinking about mostly was the blanket statement, he is stupid, without giving any indication why you think he's stupid, or whether or not that could be filtered by some evidential. So when somebody says he is stupid, it is harder to combat that. You have to ask all sorts of questions like, why do you think he's stupid? What makes you think he's stupid?
I think that if you've got to say he's stupid, which is, of course, what you say in African-American English.
Yeah, he's stupid. Right.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Even though you don't have the copula, you're equating to things.
And if you're talking to an African-American English speaker, then you're going to have to do things like say, why do you say that, and what is the basis of your claim, and all of those things. But if you're speaking Ladan, you're going to say, he's stupid based upon the evidence of my own senses. That is, I saw him do something stupid, and I was there at the time, or he's stupid because I trust the source of the information. You're going to have to say, obligatorily, to make your sentence grammatical, you're going to have to say what the basis of your information is.
It just seemed to me that a lot of the purpose of your adding evidentials and adding other clarifiers was to establish a better rapport and better understanding in conversation, and that you've written about this, which is also doing the same sort of thing.
That wasn't it at all. With the nonfiction, with the verbal self-defense book, my goal is definitely to establish trust and rapport and to eliminate conflict and decrease hostility and so on. But with Ladan, what I was concerned about was saving women all of the work that they now have to do in order to be able to communicate at all. That is, it appeared to me that women have to do a tremendous amount of body language work all the time. No resources are available to them in written language for doing that, very limited resources. And my goal was to fix that. It was to provide them with a more adequate way to communicate their perceptions.
Could you give an example of something that's very cumbersome to do in English, but that would be easier to communicate in Ladan?
Sure. The word radus, it means to non-use, to deliberately deprive someone of any useful function in the world, for example, to keep a human being as a pet. And there's a whole set of words like that. There's rahib, non-crime, a terrible thing that done deliberately because there was no choice, never an accident and never a source of blame. There's basom, which is non-pillow, a lean on me so I can step aside and let you fall down sort of person.
Yes, I like that.
For all of those things, which take a very long time for a woman to express, and people stop listening and go away, I provided in Ladan a simple word, just a word, that expressed the entire concept.
Why do you feel that these are particularly female concepts?
Because it is usually, now, I have to say first, this is for my generation, all right? It is usually the man who becomes unwilling to go on listening, and the woman who is still trying desperately to communicate whatever it is she wants to say. And therefore, I didn't feel that men needed any more vocabulary. A man has, for example, an enormous array of names for every conceivable part of a weapon. You know, there's no such thing as the smallest part of a weapon that doesn't have its own name. But women, when they want to talk about something, often they have to go on and on and on forever. I didn't feel that men were in any way a muted group, on the contrary.
Could it be that this is because, for women of your generation, you want to explain more than men, and that there's actually more content there to say, and therefore it takes longer?
You mean old ladies are awfully talkative?
I don't mean specifically old ladies. I mean, even if we consider 40 years ago and you're not an old lady. But if there was just more content there that you're saying compared to men who, you know, don't say as much because they don't have as much to say.
You know, I don't think that that's the situation. I think that is the question of men having available a vocabulary that is absolutely adequate for the things that they want to talk about, whereas women don't have an adequate vocabulary for the things that they want to talk about. You think about the fact that there is, for example, no word in English for what a woman does during the sexual act.
Yes.
There is no such word. Dale Spender pointed that out. Can you imagine men putting up with that? No, they come up with words immediately. There is only one word, one acceptable word for an experience that a woman has every single month of her life as an adult until she goes through menopause, like menstruation. And it's a word that violates the sound system of English, and that's the only one there is. You know, it's... Women are constantly in a situation of there not being any vocabulary available for the things that they particularly want to talk about. And that just isn't something that men have to deal with.
Is there any particular reason that you couldn't, instead of creating a whole nother language, that you couldn't add vocabulary to English to express these concepts?
Of course you can. And in fact, that is what native speakers, female native speakers of English have been doing at a great rate. You know, there are all sorts of feminist dictionaries and feminist glossaries and coined words that women have tried to introduce. On the other hand, there have been, I think, 80 attempts to introduce a non-gendered singular third-person pronoun, and not a one of them has succeeded. You know?
I actually use those.
What's that expression?
I actually do use gender-neutral third-person pronouns. I use the Z-Zer style.
Yeah, but try doing it in your application for a job or your application for a loan. You know, it's very, very difficult to get new vocabulary established, particularly if you are not the... dominant gender.
I did want to tell you what that's you, Professor Elgin, what one of my most sophisticated students in my honors class did, and that was he defended the language for its precision. And he read an essay of yours on meaning. Unfortunately, I don't have that text, and I turned the paper back. But I recall his saying, that you had said that the burden of making a hearer understand rests upon the speaker. Can you address that? And what was that essay? Where did you read that?
I really do feel, and it's not anything unique to me, it's a truism in linguistics, I guess, that the meaning of any utterance, the only practical real-world meaning of any utterance is what the listener understands it to have, because that is what will cause the listener to do something or other, or say something or other, to react. And you have to, as a speaker, take responsibility for making your meaning clear. If you don't provide enough information to make it possible for your meaning to be clear, then you're going to be misunderstood and things are going to happen that were not what you intended to have happen.
Yes, okay. Is there any counter-argument to that, that you are yourself countering? From medieval times on up, it seems that there is let me take another example. If we are reading the work of someone who cannot answer back or correct us, like the Beowulf poet or Aldhelm, for instance, where does the meaning reside?
I'm not sure how to answer your question because I'm not sure exactly what you mean by it.
Right, okay. In living discourse between two people, it's, of course, on the burden of the speaker to make themselves understood. And isn't it also the burden of the listener to listen well and not deliberately misconstrue what you said?
Yes. Yes, it is. And it's an interactive group always, and there's a responsibility on both sides. But the person who is speaking or writing, okay, doesn't have any excuse if they're misunderstood.
I guess my other question was irrelevant, because I deal all the time with trying to interpret dead poets. And you know, what did Theodore Röttgen mean by this? Or what did Milton mean by this? So I've had to deal with exegesis and interpretation where they're speaking essentially a different language. And so your language then would assume that
if the dead poet is unable to evoke in the reader the emotional experience that was intended, then the dead poet has simply failed. It's not the fault of the reader, and it's not the fault of the listener in the real world. Now, philosophically and theoretically, you can always say things like, well, the listener should have been better informed, the listener should have asked more questions, things like that. But in the real world, the effect that a particular utterance or a particular written sequence produces depends entirely upon the person who puts it together. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Yes.
If I could ask a very different question, Dr. Elgin.
Sure.
Tolkien is well known for having said that he created whole Middle Earth and the series of books that he did as a way to express the language that he had already been toying with and as a vehicle for bringing that to full fruition.
Yes, he did.
And you've said that you created Laodan from a desire to express women's language. And my question is, which came first, your writing or this feminist idea that wasn't quite expressed yet?
Okay, it was certainly not what happened with Tolkien, you know, was philologist, of course, with all of his changing languages all his life, and had this obsessional hobby. I didn't even know there was such thing as expressive language before I started writing native tongues. And the only reason that I worked on the language was because I felt it was my ethical responsibility. You know, the scientific background that I have is the science of linguistics, and I felt, therefore, that it was my obligation to include a demonstration of what it would actually be like to create a language. And for a linguist, that's an easy task. It's something you can do half a dozen times before breakfast, especially now that we have computers. So
I think Sally might contest that. She's been at it for how many decades now?
An addict as a conliner.
Yeah. Sally is more like Tolkien. You know, for her, this was a passion. For me, it was just a plot element in my novel.
How do you even come up with the idea of creating a language in the first place? Because that's not something most people even think to do.
Well, the women in native tongue were having a terrible time communicating with the men. And they had been working for a long time, but they had, you know, they were actually working on a decoy language that wasn't the real one. And then they were working on Ladan in secret. And it was just something that appealed to me very much. I had run into three things at the same time when I was writing native tongue. I was reading Gödel Escherbach. That had gotten me thinking about how a language could actually destroy a culture. I was thinking about the superior worth hypothesis, and it seemed to me to be extremely important to determine whether change in language brings about social change or whether it's the other way around, you know, because if it's the other way around, then there's no point at all in trying to get rid of sexist language. It's not going to have any effect upon the culture. And I had the novel going at the same time, and then there was this muted group theory, which claimed that human languages were inadequate to express the perceptions of women, and that was an extraordinary paradox because it meant that the only mechanism women had available for expressing their perceptions was one that was inadequate. So all of those things fell together for me, and the idea of constructing the language was just an ethical obligation.
Did you extend your language invention beyond the novel when you wrote the first dictionary and grammar of La Don, and did you find it fun? Did you get tremendous pleasure from this pursuit?
Well, you know, when the book came out, it was done as a surprise for me by
yes.
the SF3 group that run WISCON every year, the Feminist Science Fiction Convention. And that meant that the first edition came out as just an incredible mess because I hadn't seen it and it hadn't been proofread and it hadn't been copy edited and it was in this language that nobody that was working on it knew, but it was given to me as a gift. And so it needed to be done over again. And doing it over again, it didn't really improve it a great deal. I think there are still an enormous number of typographical errors in that the second edition. Fortunately, we now have online at my website a link to a dictionary in both directions, Ladan to English and English to Ladan, that has been copy edited within an inch of its life. So it is now possible for people to take that second edition book and check it against the online dictionary and correct the mess.
Do you also have the grammar online?
The grammar itself is not online, but the complete dictionary in both directions with all of the new words that have been added to it over the years since the first edition of the book came out, that's all online now. You just go to my website and the site map and you see the links to the Ladan to English grammar and the English to Ladan grammar. And those are reliable.
Right. If I could ask a follow-up to something that you were discussing earlier. You mentioned that you were studying both the muted group hypothesis and Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
Yes.
And it seems to me that there's a bit of a contradiction here in that at least strong Sapir-Whorf hypothesis would make one conclude that if you have a language that is inadequate to express certain feelings, then one would be less likely to have those feelings because one can't express them and therefore one can't easily think them. Do you think that this is accurate or no?
We know that's not true. You know, we know that the fact that your language doesn't have a word for chair doesn't mean that if somebody puts a chair down before you and demonstrates to you how to sit in it, that you will find that chair invisible and untouchable and all the rest of that. We know that's not true. The strong form of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is rightly regarded as nonsense.
What about for things where it's not so clear that it's a direct perceptual thing? where it's a more ambiguous internal perception of how to regard a certain event or how to describe feelings?
Well, for example, in English, by calling menopause an illness, you turn a woman into a patient. Shazam. You know, she has to go to doctors, and she has to have medicine, and she has to have treatment, and her whole family is disrupted and all this mess. And this is done by medicalizing a word. You know, you call menopause hypoestrogenemia, and all of a sudden you have some sort of a disorder and an illness. We know perfectly well that the weak form of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is valid, and that way that what things are named really does make a difference in how they are perceived in the real world. We know that. But the strong form is, of course, nonsense.
Right. What do you think are the most interesting phrases or expressions in Lhadan?
This is a feature that actually exists in Navajo, and I found it so convenient and handy in Navajo that I've always wished that English had it too. In Navajo, there is a phoneme that sounds like this. Okay. It isn't part of English. And it adds the negative. So if you're saying that the baby is crying and the verb is yada, and you say yadash, then that means, oh, damn, the baby is crying. And I always thought how wonderful it would be if we used good like that in English, and you could say the good Congress and the good president. So I added that to Lhadan. I think that's it. I think it's interesting that in Lhadan, internal perception is distinct from external perception. So you have an entirely different verb for perceiving something with your sensory organs, your eyes and your ears and your skin and so on, and completely different from the one for perceiving something that's going on inside you, like an emotion.
Could you give examples of those?
If you say the woman was joyful, that's and that means that she felt internally this joy inside her, okay? But I hear a sound, and that means literally, I hear a sound with my ears. And I don't think that I don't know of a human language that makes that specific distinction and that insists on saying what sensory organ the perception comes. So I think that's it. And then in terms of the idiom, I think that the raw forms that I was talking to you about earlier, like the non-use and the non-crime, the non-pillow, I think those are interesting, and people have been more interested in those forms than in the other aspects of the language, so far as I know. I've gotten more correspondence and more reactions. Anything else.
Well, especially the word for, I think it's Lila.
What does that mean?
The word for the female experience of having sex. I mean, that's the one that I adored, perhaps emotionally and intellectually, because, for very complicated and obvious reasons. So I suppose what I liked best about Lhadan were some of the emotional sensibilities and subtleties that you give. Some of my students, however, objected that, you know, the word love already has so many meanings that it's context that makes it clear. So how would you address that?
Well, they're correct. And if you add the context, then you're just fine. The problem is that often adding the context makes you have to go on and on and on and on, and people stop being interested and they stop listening. So I was just trying to be more efficient by providing specific words to fit each of these varieties of the emotion.
Mm-hmm. I might have asked this. I don't know if I asked this. So in my chapter on conlanging, I put you in a category with Ursula K. Le Guin's Kesh and Always Coming Home. And I was wondering if you were aware of that. There are some differences and similarities. The biggest difference is that she included the language, but she wasn't as philosophically interested in it as you are. But the correlations is that Kesh seems to be designed for an agrarian, peaceful society, and it has a strong spiritual element to it, which I perceive to be important in La Dan. And can you talk about the spiritual element in La Dan? I noticed that the examples you give of poetry are hymns and the Lord's Prayer.
Well, you know, that is an accident. it was a diagnostic probe phenomenon. What happened was that when I started putting the vocabulary together, what I took as a task was to translate the King James Bible, which I consider to be the most masculine chunk of English available, into La Dan. And so that is how that happened. I got a lot of criticism for it about trying to proselytize as a Christian or something like that. It wasn't that at all. It was just that the King James Bible is so extraordinarily patriarchal and masculine that I knew that trying to translate chunks of it would serve as a diagnostic probe to point out to me where the missing things were. And that is how that happened.
That's interesting. Let me see if I can...
That I perceived La Dan as this incredibly spiritual language. I didn't. I perceived it as a nonviolent language.
And a practical language, yes.
Well, yes, and as a language that would make it easier not to have a lot of conflict in communication. You know, I was working at sort of decreasing the opportunities to get into fights just because it worked better. Just because there was an adequate vocabulary, that sort of thing. So it wasn't that I was trying to make it spiritual, but working with the King James Bible definitely introduced spirituality into it. And then, of course, when I wrote Judas Rose, the second book in the trilogy, I had an awful lot of fun with the nuns translating the King James Bible into La Dan and deliberately doing it as badly as they possibly could.
I see. All right. What's interesting is Ursula Le Guin gives us one interlinear translation of a sentence in Keshe, and that's the only way that you can figure out any of her grammar. But she renders William Blake's "The whole business of man is the arts and all things common," and her translation makes it something entirely different. and so I think that in some ways one of the real successes of a conlang is that you just don't have a calc for everything in English, that you actually provide your words with different connotations. And this is why I think that this is strong, La Dan, and why Keshe is strong too. And I find the best conlangs to do that.
Well, always coming home is, of course, a monumental effort.
Yes.
I think all that Ursula was trying to do with the glossary was to just give us examples, because she was working from anthropology rather than from linguistics.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I was obligated to actually construct a grammar.
Right.
She didn't have that burden.
No. I would ask her that.
I would really like to see a grammar of Keshe. I think that would be wonderful.
I'm wondering if she even got that far. I don't know. It's hard to determine how much of the iceberg we're actually seeing with this, or if it's the whole thing.
We could try calling her up and seeing if she'd be willing to come on the show.
We could. She said something about it in the Dictionary of Alien and Invented Languages. I don't see it on my bookshelf here. She made some comment about it.
Dr. Elgin, I know that we're running a little bit low on time, and I just wanted to ask, is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
You know, you've covered an extraordinary range of things. The only thing I think that you had asked me, when you sent me the list of questions, you had asked me, how do I feel about neurolinguistic programming? I would just like to say that I feel that what happened with neurolinguistic programming was very unfortunate.
How so?
No quality control. It's an extraordinarily powerful technique for taking people apart and putting them back together. And I worked with John Grinder at the beginning of NLP, and then we parted ways over the ethics of the whole thing, because there was absolutely no mechanism for keeping other people from taking off with it and just running in in 50,000 directions, and as a result, we've got all this mess.
Do you mean that people are using it in ways that you find distasteful, or do you mean that people have since come up with extensions that simply haven't been experimentally proven?
You know, it's not even a matter of being experimentally proven. It's the problem of people writing books about neuro-linguistic programming without having a clue about either neurology or linguistics. And that there was no mechanism built in. I'm not sure exactly how John Grinder and Richard Bandler could have gone about building in anything of that kind, but that it wasn't trademarked, it wasn't registered, And so as a result, you have these just travesties, books and seminars and whole empires built on a foundation of no neurology and no linguistics. And I think that's very unfortunate.
I just wanted to know what neuro-linguistic programming was, because not everybody listening to this podcast might know what it is, and I don't.
Neuro-linguistic programming is a form of talking therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. And it is extremely useful for some sorts of problems and has been used all over the place in a lot of unfortunate ways.
And there are techniques in NLP about ways to manipulate people by how you speak, mirroring them in certain ways, gaining compliance and having somebody start to mirror your emotions, mirror your speech, so that you have more control over the situation. It's a very broad topic that has gotten broader over time.
I'm going to research this.
Well, and it got broader as the years went by, yes.
Yes. Dr. Elgin, thank you very much for your time.
Yes.
For discussing your language and your work. Or perhaps I should say, Alan Hothul. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
It has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks today to Gary J. Shannon for our intro and outro music, Virgo for editing the audio, and of course to Dr. Elgin for agreeing to discuss her language.
You can find more of Gary's music at his website, fizzywig.com, and of Virgo's audio at intraxis.com/virgoaudio. You can read more about Dr. Elgin's books, essays, and online newsletters at her website, sfwa.org/members/Elgin. Elgin is spelled E-L-G-I-N.
This podcast would not be possible without you. So please, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions for people to interview, music we could use, skill in audio editing, or an interesting story to share, email or IM us at lcs@conlang.org or visit our website, conlang.org.
I hope you've enjoyed today's edition of the Language Creation Society podcast. See you next time.
Fiat lingua.
Thank you.